thank all of you who made this possible this evening. All of the effort that you made and all of the people whose names I haven't mentioned, but who did all of the work at the precinct level, who got out the vote, who did all of the effort, brought forth all of the effort that's required. I was a campaign manager 8 years ago. I know what a difference that kind of an effort and that kind of commitment makes. So I thank all of you, those of you who are here. Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
On this day, 50 years ago, Robert Kennedy was shot in L.A.'s Ambassador Hotel. He had just won the California primary and was on his way to becoming the Democratic presidential candidate in 1968. He died the following day. We're going to remember his California campaign and how his death signaled to many the end of the 1960s. That's in a few minutes. First, though, Mayor Eric Garcetti has picked a new police chief for L.A. His name is Michael Moore. Moore is currently an assistant chief. He's been with the LAPD for some 36 years. He's known for crunching data. He created the department's first automated crime mapping system. Some city council members are disappointed, though. They wanted a Latino chief instead. It's up to the council to confirm Moore. We're going to talk about this now with Joel Rubin, staff writer with the LA Times. Hi, Joel.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. And David Zanizer, he covers City Hall for the Times. Hi.
Hello.
Dave, you were at City Hall yesterday when Garcetti announced his decision. What were the reasons he gave for choosing Moore over the other two?
The mayor described him as a reformer. He said Moore has exceptional intelligence. He said that he's one of the most qualified law enforcement professionals in America. He appeared with Moore and Chief Beck, who was leaving at the end of the month. And when he made his announcement, he said, "No one works harder, no one reads more, and no one has a greater breadth of experience." So pretty high praise.
Yeah. And so the other two finalists were Deputy Chief Robert Arcos, Mexican-American,
yes.
And Bill Scott, an African-American.
Yes. And he's a chief from San Francisco, but he spent many years with the LAPD. So really, it was three LAPD guys.
Right. Okay. And Joel Moore joined the LAPD back in 1981. How was he viewed as he moved up the ranks?
Yeah, he is a lifer. He's more than three decades, as you said, and he really has moved up through the ranks. He has either served in the trenches or overseen as a supervisor, really, most, if not all, the major assignments in the department. And as he has climbed up, as Dave said, he's earned this reputation of being a real smart, nuts and bolts, demanding supervisor and commander. He has not encountered any major scandals or personality, battles with others. So in as much as you can in the LAPD, he has, had a full, really successful career without really being dirtied up by any major scandals, mm-hmm. or any real big problems. And so, I think as much as you can starts this new job as chief with not necessarily a clean slate, but people saying, all right, we're going to give you a chance.
Yeah. And he was involved in two police shootings when he was, a policeman, when he was a patrolman, I guess, and cleared of those.
Yeah. He had two shootings, which, that's not, I don't think we should read anything into that. There are plenty of police officers who go through such a long career and, mm-hmm. and find themselves in a situation where they have to use deadly force. As you said, he was cleared in both. One was a off-duty incident when he was moonlighting as a security guard, which he actually received a lot of praise from the chief at the time for staying cool under fire. A man who was trying to kill his wife, I believe, or actually did kill his wife, and Moore was able to kill him. And then the other one, he was cleared of or was found to have been within department policy, a shooting at a loading dock where a man was wielding a gun and trying to shoot some truck drivers, I believe. But yeah, it's something certainly that I'm sure informs his understanding of what it means to be a rank and file cop. And, with that in his, sort of memory, I think it helps when he assesses whether a cop was doing his job or not.
And Dave, there was some controversy over the choice of Moore over the other two men. In at least one city councilman says he's maybe not so pleased. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, so what happened over the course of, you know, this is a pretty long process, ultimately. You know, the mayor had four rounds of interviews with his three finalists. You know, his three finalists presented him by his appointees on the police commission. And so once they were narrowed down to three, you know, one of the three, Robert Arcos, you know, there was sort of a campaign, sort of a grassroots campaign for him. And that was, on some level, spearheaded by Gil Cedillo, who's a councilman who represents neighborhoods from MacArthur Park to Lincoln Heights, sort of an east side-ish district. And so he signed a letter along with four former council members, all of them who had represented the east side, all Latino, saying that they thought Arcos should be picked. He would have been the first Latino police chief. He's Mexican-American. And that they felt that that would send an important message in the middle of the sort of the Trump era with a debate about, you know, how police interact with undocumented immigrants. So he was very strong for him. And so not long after, in fact, I think the press conference may still have been going on, Cedillo put out a statement yesterday saying, you know, hey, just want to be clear, this is one step in the process and the city council still has to confirm the guy. And he said, you know, the council members are going to decide what experience matters most and who the police chief will be. So this was, by the way, a departure. Generally, you know, the reactions from most of the elected officials that we've heard from so far have been very positive. Mitch O'Farrell said he wants to confirm the guy. You know, City Controller Ron Galperin said, you know, he's ready to work on day one. So the Cedillo statement was definitely a departure from that mood.
Okay. And Chief Beck retiring June 27th. So presumably Moore would take over just after that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they would need to confirm him by then. And I would point out that, like, the city council, you know, the mayor presents many nominees. He presents people for city commissions and other posts. And over 5 years, I don't believe the council has ever rejected one.
Okay.
So if you're looking for a guide, that might be one.
All righty. Dave Zanheiser, Joel Rubin, both at the LA Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up. 50 years ago today, Robert Kennedy won the California primary, but he was shot at his victory party at the LA Ambassador Hotel. How his death changed the course of history, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's primary day here in California, and by tradition, we here at KCRW do not report on politics the day of the primary. But on this day, 50 years ago, Robert F. Kennedy won the California primary. He gave a victory speech that night at the Ambassador Hotel here in L.A.
What I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of next year.
He wanted to unite a divided nation that was reeling from the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. just 2 months before, from the Watts riots in 1965, and his brother's assassination in 1963. Well, after he left the stage that night, the crowd at the Ambassador was ebullient.
RFK!
But moments later, Kennedy would be shot.
A doctor, we need a doctor right here. The microphone, please, immediately.
Bobby Kennedy was taken to Good Samaritan Hospital, where he died the following day. And his death, for many, also signaled the death of the 1960s. For more now, we turn to Larry Tye, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, tell us more about the 1968 presidential race. Kennedy was in and the California primary and his victory in California. What did that mean for him and for the campaign?
So the part of that speech that you didn't play, the very end, he said, "And it's on to Chicago and let's win there." And that actually had two meanings. One was on to Chicago that summer for the big Democratic convention, and he was all geared up for that. But what it really meant, and nobody knew that night, was on to Chicago the next morning to meet with arguably the most powerful Democratic power broker in America, Mayor Richard Daley. And 50 years later, Daley's son, Bill Daley, tells us that his father was going to endorse Bobby Kennedy the next day. And what that would have meant, the most powerful power broker in America endorsing Bobby, and more importantly, not endorsing Hubert Humphrey, who was counting on people like Daley to give him the votes from the non-primary states. I think what it would have meant is it would have set off a tidal wave of endorsements, and it would have meant that Bobby Kennedy was the clear nominee in Chicago that summer. And the ticket, I believe, would have been the two strongest Democrats, Bobby Kennedy as president and Hubert Humphrey as vice president. And you can imagine coming out of a convention without a riot the way there was in Chicago, coming out with a ticket as strong as Kennedy and Humphrey, and facing a candidate in Richard Nixon, who Bobby had led a successful campaign against 8 years before on behalf of his brother. I think it would have meant a Bobby Kennedy presidency.
Wow. So that single event at the Ambassador Hotel really changed the course of history in your mind.
It changed the course of history in about as profound a way as you can imagine. The idea of Bobby Kennedy as president instead of Richard Nixon, you don't get much more dramatic a choice than that.
Tell us more about Bobby Kennedy's campaign in California and what it symbolized, because here was a man who had really his liberal credentials had evolved to the point where he was campaigning with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Dolores Huerta was on the stage with him that night at the Ambassador. He had campaigned in Watts and was really embracing embracing African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and people of color in a way that few candidates did at the time.
So that campaign, to me, was a reflection of what Bobby Kennedy could have meant as president. He turned out a Latino vote that we had never seen in this country before. 100% of Latinos, essentially, in just about every community, coming out in numbers that they had never turned out for the primary or any race before, thanks in part to Cesar Chavez and thanks to Bobby just connecting. He turned out an African-American vote that was extraordinary, but he also had enough white votes. I think what Bobby Kennedy in 2018 terms represented in that California primary was uniting angry, white, Donald Trump kinds of voters who were with him from his early Joe McCarthy Cold Warrior days, with a Hillary Clinton kind of coalition of liberals and blacks, precisely the kind of bridge building that we dream of in an equally divided America today.
We'll talk a little bit about his past. You say he worked for Senator Joe McCarthy. So describe a little bit about how his liberalism evolved.
So it evolved in a way that I think was a lens into how America was evolving from the conservative era of Eisenhower to the tumultuous 1960s. Bobby Kennedy didn't just go to work for Joe McCarthy. He went to work enthusiastically, an equally avid Cold Warrior in that period when America believed that the Soviets posed a threat behind every pillar in the State Department. And I think that Bobby Kennedy's transformation to the liberal icon that he became was not just blowing with the political winds, but helping steer those political winds. And it gave me faith that a politician could change without being a flip-flopper.
And what was it that made him change? Was there a single event, or was it just a gradual evolution?
It was the way he learned. He learned by experiencing, by making lots of mistakes, and then by trying to get better. And if there was any single event, it was his epiphany moment, which was the assassination of his brother. And he was already on a pendulum going from ruthless to tender. The dial moved a whole lot faster after that event in in November of 1963 when he heard that his brother had been shot and killed in Dallas.
And it really is remarkable to think that 50 years ago today, when he was standing on that stage at the Ambassador Hotel and talking about uniting a divided nation and going on to Chicago, that he was only 42 years old.
It's extraordinary. And to me, he will always be the Bobby Kennedy with a cowlick, with his hair blowing in the wind, with buck teeth, and looking forever young. And that is the sense of hope and of hope crushed that his victory represented that night in California 50 years ago.
And do you agree that this was basically the end of the 1960s and the end of the 1960s idealism?
It was, but I think that we can also recapture the Bobby Kennedy spirit, and we have to do it today because we're facing so many of the same problems. And he offers, I think, a way out of the wilderness for progressives.
Larry Tai, his biography is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the man who shot Bobby Kennedy and who was convicted of that crime was Sirhan Sirhan. He is still in prison 50 years later. He lived in Pasadena at the time, and the house he lived in, his family home, is still there. It's occupied by his last living relative. Peter Gilstrap went to visit.
Is it recording? Are we recording now?
Yeah, I just turned it on to get the level.
Okay.
What's that chirping?
A clock.
Yeah, okay.
Every hour it chirps a different... You know, 1 hour it's a mockingbird, another hour it's a blue jay, and I enjoy it.
On a serene, leafy street in North Pasadena, a 70-year-old man has lived a quiet life in a well-preserved craftsman house since his family bought it in 1963. He keeps the lawn mowed, he chats with the neighbors, and sometimes he smokes Parliament cigarettes with his tea on the front porch. On a June day 50 years ago, one of his older brothers left this same house with a loaded .22 pistol. He got into his pink and white 56 DeSoto and drove to a gun range. Later that evening, he headed to the Ambassador Hotel on Wilshire Boulevard.
Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
The senator had just won California's Democratic primary election. After his speech, he left the stage and entered a small, crowded kitchen pantry. He never made it to Chicago.
Still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. Get the gun.
Get the gun.
His hand is frozen. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Go hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb.
Kennedy was down, taking two bullets in the back and one in the head. 26 hours later, he was dead.
The suspect, now being held by Los Angeles police in connection with the Kennedy shooting, is 24-year-old Sirhan Bishara Sirhan.
He was just a fun-loving guy. He liked life, and he liked family.
This is Munir Sirhan, the man with the chirping clock, and the brother of Kennedy's convicted assassin.
If anybody was trying to do me any harm, he'd go up there and, confront the people and tell them, listen, this is my little brother. I don't want anybody hurting him.
Sirhan Sirhan was tried and sentenced to the gas chamber, a sentence that was commuted to life in 1972. Since then, he's been denied parole 15 times, but his brother keeps the faith.
You know what? I just want to hug him. I want to hug him and tell him, welcome home. So I'd just like to see him, reading a book on that chair like he used to when we were kids, and just walk around the block with him. I'd be happy.
For the last 50 years, Munir has waited for his brother to return to this house in Pasadena. And for the last 50 years, he's lived in the wake of his brother's actions. Munir leads a solitary life, never got married, never had a career. He keeps the furniture in the house pretty much as it was the day Sirhan drove away. Of the family's parents and six children, Munir and his older brother are the only ones left.
Unfortunately, Sirhan and I. Sirhan and I. It'd be pretty rough without him, even if it was just letter writing.
In the 1950s, the Sirhans, who were Arab-Palestinian Christians, were living in Jerusalem, an area experiencing continued upheaval from the 1948 Arab-Israeli War.
The Suez Crisis burst dramatically into the news again. For Israel has invaded Egypt. Background to these startling events is the running sore of the Israel-Egypt frontier. For many years, even the village schools in the frontier settlements have known that at any moment, death may be looking over their shoulder.
Muneer says this was the violent backdrop for his early childhood memories.
A lot of hecticness, a lot of hecticness, a lot of air raid sirens going on every other day just about. I remember going to my best friend's home, and they're telling me he's not coming to school today and wondering why, and then the next day you find out that he got blown away from a bomb.
A ship overcrowded with seasick refugees brought the family to America in 1956, leaving the Holy Land for the paradise of Pasadena. But it wasn't perfect.
You know, we got along. We made friends. It was okay, but you couldn't be an Arab here. You couldn't be an Arab at all. Although we all got along, even at back home, we lived in what they referred to as the Jewish sector, and we got along with Muslims, Jews, Christians, and any other the Holy City. You know, they had open arms to any nationality and any religion as it was.
His devout mother Mary got a job in the nursery at Westminster Presbyterian Church, just walking distance from the house. His father returned to the old country, unable to adapt to life in the States. Their two youngest sons started attending local public schools and got paper routes. Sirhan was a reader. At John Muir High School in Pasadena, the same school Jackie Robinson attended, he joined the ROTC and learned to shoot a .22 rifle. Muneer had bad eyesight and quit school after sixth grade. He watched a lot of TV, Yogi Bear, Felix the Cat, The Three Stooges. He was becoming an American, which also meant buying records.
Who work all night and a drink of rum?
I used to love Stan Freeberg. I don't know if you remember him. Yeah, I used to, pantomime his skits, like Banana Boat about the bongos. Some guy, oh no, man, that's too loud. Wow, man, back off.
Too loud, man, too loud.
You know, I think that's what I would have been, some sort of a comedy songwriter or something.
But that didn't happen. He got a job at F.C. Nash Department Store in Pasadena as a stock clerk. Yet this mundane position was not without dark significance. Through a coworker, Muneer got his brother a gun.
He asked me if I could get a gun. Sirhan, because he used to belong to the ROTC when he was at Muir, I said, sure, I'll ask. So I asked a fellow employee, and he said, yeah, I have a friend that has one that he wants to sell.
According to LAPD interview transcripts from 1968, Muneer tried to talk his brother out of buying the .22, finally demanding that he swear on their dead sister's memory that he would, quote, go to the rifle range one time and then throw it away, end quote. Sirhan did swear, but, quote, he didn't carry it through. So one night in January, Muneer's work buddy drove over to the house in a Corvair, pulled up in front, and honked. He had an Ivor Johnson 8-shooter in a box. Sirhan came out on the porch, and they made the deal.
But I had no idea. Putting a gun in Sirhan's hand would be like putting a rattler in a baby's mouth. I had no idea that this, would have this kind of an outcome. No idea at all. You kind of start looking inward to see if you were part of the blame for this thing happening.
On the morning of June 6th, Muneer went to work at Nash's. He stepped into the employee's lounge before clocking in. For him, at this point, it was still just another Thursday.
The TV was on loud, and the room was full. And usually it's not that full unless it's somebody's birthday. And I'm thinking it's too early to celebrate a birthday this early. And walked over and put in coins in the coffee machine. I took a couple of sips of my coffee, looked at the screen.
There is not yet an official identification of the suspect. But you see him there.
And it looked like Sirhan. I said, whoa, picture came on again. I said, that's my brother.
So within a matter of seconds, Muneer's day goes from another 8 hours in housewares to the shock that his brother is being held for shooting Robert F. Kennedy. What went through his mind?
I thought when this thing happened that they got the wrong guy, just as they had in the situation with the warrant.
Here's that situation. Muneer says years before he'd received a citation for hitchhiking that turned into a warrant. Later, Sirhan was stopped for a traffic infraction, and the cop ran a check. When the name Muneer Bishara Sirhan came up, the officer arrested Sirhan Bishara Sirhan. But this was not that. Muneer borrowed his boss's car, picked up his brother Adele from home, and they headed for the Pasadena police station.
The officer didn't seem too interested, so we walked away. And when we walked away, Adele happened to gaze at a newsstand, and there it was, seeing his picture on the front page. So he grabbed the paper and went back to the desk sergeant. Told him, "Listen, this is my brother." I remember the guy's look. He said, "Oh." And then all hell broke loose. What can I tell you?
Police Chief Redden said the Ceron family has been most cooperative in the investigation.
Well, we know very little bit. He's been non-communicative, and he hasn't been very helpful. He hasn't told the family about what he's been up to at all, so we don't know anything more than you do.
When things somewhat cooled down after we spoke with the FBI, after we spoke with the police, the LA police and Pasadena police, and Mother and I went down to see him.
Did he say anything to you, like, about I did this or didn't do this?
Oh, no. Well, Mother asked him, what happened? He said, "I don't remember. I don't know. All I know is my leg hurts and I think it was one of his thumbs that were hurting." But he didn't remember. He specifically said, "I don't remember what happened."
This lack of memory of the actual shooting of Kennedy is something that Sirhan has continued to maintain. Though in a 1989 TV interview, he said his motivation to target Kennedy was the senator's support of Israel. Muneer says his brother never shared those feelings with him.
I mean, did he have animosity towards the Kennedys or ever about that?
None of us were politically inclined.
And then there's the Manchurian theory. Sirhan was acting under hypnosis and was a patsy assassin meant to draw attention from the actual killer. This could explain his calm demeanor that witnesses remarked upon immediately after the shooting and the notebook police later found in his bedroom with "RFK must die" scrawled repeatedly, something hypnotism advocates say was automatic writing done during a trance state.
I know this sounds like a cliche, but he had played around with hypnotism and that. Somewhere along the line, he learned how to self-hypnotize himself, or somebody got into his head.
In the living room of the family house, there's a built-in glass-doored bookcase filled with volumes about the Kennedys.
Did you buy all these books?
Yeah.
All the Kennedy stuff you buy, but you don't read them.
Yeah. No, but I knew I would one of these days, or I'd have to.
Sandwiched in between the Kennedy titles, on the same shelf as yellowing copies of Word Power Made Easy and How to Win Friends and Influence People, is an old hardback that belongs to Sirhan.
There's a book here that deals with the personality or something. I asked him about it one day, but it never got any clear answers.
Oh, The Laws of Mental Domination?
Yeah.
That was Sirhan's book?
Yeah.
Hypnosis and brainwashing and mind control aside, forensic evidence states that the shot that killed Kennedy came from no more than 3 inches from the back of his head, where an armed private security guard had drawn his weapon. Eyewitnesses place Sirhan as never closer than a few feet away and approaching Kennedy from the front. An audio tape recorded in the kitchen pantry that night surfaced in 2004. Experts say it reveals up to 13 shots fired. Sirhan's gun held 8. This knowledge and its implications, the whole second gunman theory, are what Muneer clings to.
I wasn't there, but the people that were, they all say that they heard more shots. Sirhan wasn't close enough. There was a lot of controversy. These are eyewitnesses. It was not us making, the family making these things up. When we heard those things, it gave us a little bit of hope that maybe, Sirhan didn't do it like we thought all along. It wasn't Sirhan. Not my brother.
At moments like this, sitting in the still and quiet dining room with his cigarette burning slowly in the ashtray, you can feel the helpless frustration that's weighed upon Muneer for decades over a situation he didn't ask for, but one he has accepted as best he can. Eileen Sloman, her husband Peter, and son Ernie have lived next door to Muneer for almost 30 years. To her, he's just Manny.
I love Manny. He's a really nice guy. He's a great neighbor. When we're gone, he watches the house, and when he's gone, we'll watch the house. And just a few years ago, he gave me his phone number. It's just like little at a time.
Over the decades, she's seen the odd tour bus cruise by. A Muneer once cautioned her to move her trash bins away from his on pickup day. Souvenir hunters sometimes root through the garbage.
So he's very guarded. He's very private. And he doesn't trust a lot of people, and there's a lot of reasons why. You know, the fact that he trusts my husband and I is special to me. It really is.
Muneer says he's never had any problems from his neighbors, then or now. And even in public, his last name has never brought him any trouble.
I'm curious if you get recognized. Do people say...
Oh, no. I had jobs that my name would be printed on my shirt. Never had anybody that held any animosity toward us at all, no. In fact, I didn't like it, but a lot of people would say, you're famous. They would go out of their way to help because of the notoriety, and then I tell them, please, you know, I have my own individuality. That's been going on for years and years.
But his individuality is a buried and private thing. Hang around with him for a while, and he seems like a regular guy. But a regular guy is a very hard thing to be when your brother was convicted of killing a Kennedy.
On the outside, he's friendly and he loves to talk. You know, sometimes we spend hours up the fence, but I don't understand really what he's been going through. But to know that his brother, you know, his last brother, has been serving the last 50 years of his life in prison is just, it's got to be just horrible. You know, tearing him apart, basically, I think.
Sirhan is currently residing in his fifth California prison since 1968, the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility in San Diego. Driving is hard for Muneer these days, given his failing vision, so it's mostly phone calls and letters between him and Sirhan, and even those are somewhat random. But when they do come, he's still talking to his big brother.
Stop smoking. It's bad for you. You know, it's the number one killer in the United States. You know, take care of yourself. I hope the neighbors are okay with you, and you know, you're taking care of each other, looking out for each other, which we are. We all go out of our way looking out for each other.
And so Muneer marks time in the house alone. He uses Sirhan's room in the back for storage these days. There's a chandelier on the floor and a couple cardboard boxes, but the twin bed still faces a window that looks out on a lemon tree, old and gnarled and hanging with fruit. Ask Muneer what his days are like, and he shrugs, exhaling cigarette smoke. He goes to the market, does his laundry, listens to Oldie's radio while he vacuums. He talks to the lawyers when they need something, and spends his dwindling eyesight reading and rereading boxes of briefs and transcripts, still trying to make sense of everything that's consumed him for 50 years. He seems to take it all in stride, talking for hours in an even manner about things he's discussed 1,000 times before. But every now and again, just for a moment, something else comes to the surface.
You don't have a life of your own at all. I'm lost. I still am. Did he do it? Didn't he do it? People were there that say this, and people were there that say that. You know, I wasn't there. I have to rely on my brother. And he says, I don't remember.
It's been generations since that night in 1968. Who was Sirhan? Who was Robert Kennedy, even? What is indelible to older Americans has become vague or simply unknown to younger people. Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, California State Prisoner B21014, will have his next parole hearing in 2021. His brother will be waiting.
That story by KCRW contributor Peter Gilstrap. Well, coming up, was Sirhan Sirhan the lone gunman?
I don't remember the exact moment. I don't remember pulling my gun out of my body or wherever it was located, and I don't remember aiming it at any human being.
The case for a second shooter, now Robert Kennedy's son, believes Sirhan didn't act alone. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Before the break, we heard the story of Muneer Sirhan, the brother of Sirhan Sirhan, who has been in prison for some 50 years for the assassination of RFK. As it turns out, not only Muneer has doubts on whether his brother committed the assassination, other people have them too. And one of them is RFK's son, Robert Kennedy Jr. He now believes there was a second gunman and that this mystery gunman was the one who shot his father. Tom Jackman is a crime reporter for The Washington Post, and he spoke with RFK Jr. about that. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so recently RFK Jr. met with Sirhan Sirhan in prison. He spoke with him for several hours. What did he tell you about that meeting?
Not a lot, other than to say that Sirhan didn't say anything he hasn't been saying for 50 years, namely that he doesn't remember committing the shooting. He remembers going to the Ambassador Hotel. He remembers talking to a woman in the pantry. Next thing he remembers is being tackled. And so beyond the specifics of that, Bobby Kennedy Jr. didn't want to talk about it, but he did say that he thinks there needs to be a new investigation into this case.
Had he not believed until now that there was a second gunman?
He has quietly supported some of these folks for at least 5 or 6 years. In 2012, he wrote a letter to then-Attorney General Eric Holder asking him to look into this, and specifically to look into an audio tape which seems to indicate that 13 shots were fired that night when Sirhan's gun only held 8 shots. The FBI did a cursory investigation and using old equipment found that no, there were only 8 shots.
Okay, so what is Sirhan's explanation for why he was there with a gun in the first place if he didn't go there intending to shoot Bobby Kennedy?
He had a gun because he liked to do target shooting. He had been in ROTC in high school, and he had been to the target range that day and shot for hours. In fact, the police later scooped up thousands of shell casings in hopes of trying to match those to his gun. So he had been shooting that day. He went to the Ambassador that night to a victory party, not Kennedy's, but another candidate who was running for the Senate and whose daughter went to high school with him. He was hoping to, you know, happen to run into this girl that he knew. So that's why he was there. He doesn't remember going to the car and bringing the gun back in, but he acknowledges, I must have done it. And then he doesn't remember shooting, although there are people who watched him shoot. So he acknowledges, I must have done it. And so at the trial, he said, I did it. I don't remember it, but I did it.
All right. So why doesn't Bobby Kennedy Jr., why doesn't he believe that Sirhan Sirhan was the sole gunman?
It's because of some pretty basic ballistics, which were that Bobby Kennedy, the candidate, Senator Robert Kennedy, was shot in the back of the head and also shot 3 times in the back. One of the shots didn't hit him. It went through his jacket, but shot 4 times from behind. Sirhan is in front of Kennedy, could not have reached around, and this gun was put up against Kennedy's jacket. There's powder burns on the jacket. So from 1969 on, there have been people saying, how could Sirhan have done it? He was in front of Kennedy. He couldn't have put a gun against Kennedy's head.
Well, isn't it possible that Kennedy could have turned around so that his back was facing Sirhan?
Absolutely, it's possible. And that's what a number of people think, including the prosecutors and the judges who have ruled on this and some of the authors who have written about it, who say, well, what is Kennedy just supposed to stand there and let this guy shoot him? Of course he turned around. But the people who were closest to Sirhan say, whatever Kennedy did, Sirhan never got close enough to Kennedy to have put the gun against his body, so it couldn't have been Sirhan.
Paul Schrade, who was a labor organizer and there pretty much next to RFK at the time, was also shot. He was wounded in the head. And he also says that there was a second gunman. What's his evidence?
His evidence starts with that, which is he's hit by a bullet that, you know, goes in and out of the top of his head, knocks him down, knocks him backwards, and he's shot from the front, and there's 4 people near him who are also shot from the front. He believes that Sirhan shot him and shot the other wounded people, all of whom survived. He believes that because the fatal bullet was fired from behind Kennedy, who was in front of Schrade, Kennedy had to have been shot by another person, and so he has been pushing on this since 1974.
But as you say, there have been investigations which have concluded that there wasn't a second gunman. Why aren't these people buying these other subsequent investigations and their conclusions?
Well, some of the investigations bolstered them. For example, that the bullet that shot Kennedy did not match the bullet that shot one of the victims behind him. They were fired from different guns. But they would say that these investigations were suspect. They were done by people who had motive to clear the LAPD. And so, and that none of them, regardless of their results, have pushed anyone to look for a second gunman, and that's the ultimate goal of Paul Schrade and those who support him.
Do they have any idea who the second gunman might have been?
Not really. There was a security guard who was standing right behind Kennedy on Kennedy's right-hand side who would have been perfectly positioned to do that and who owned a .22 caliber gun similar to Sirhan's. He was using a .38 caliber gun as he was walking Kennedy through the pantry. He has always said, "I didn't fire, I didn't shoot. When the shooting started, I fell down. I got up, I pulled my weapon, but I didn't fire it because Sirhan had already been captured." So that guy was a suspect for many years just because he was in the exact right place. And he also has made it clear that he was not a fan of the Kennedys. But his gun was not tested, either the .38 or the .22 that he owned. And the police never treated him as a suspect. They never called him as a witness. And he sort of fell by the wayside. In the 1990s, he was given a polygraph exam, and he passed it.
So it's not just RFK Jr. His sister now, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, also thinks there should be another investigation?
She does. She isn't saying a lot about it. I had actually asked her about it probably a month ago, and she didn't want to talk about it at all. But I guess after reading her brother's comments and the points that he raises and the points that Paul Schrade raises, she told the Boston Globe and me that Bobby makes some good points, and I think there should be a new investigation.
Do you think it's possible that a new investigation could clear this up, or will there always be doubts?
It's not going to clear it up. It can provide answers to some people, but there are folks who feel that it's already answered. And why are we even talking about this? This case is closed. The U.S. courts have said, don't even file anything else. We're not accepting it. So there are so many people who have followed this case over the years, who have researched it and lived it. It would be hard to think that every question would be answered to their satisfaction.
Tom, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Tom Jackman, crime reporter for The Washington Post. He runs the True Crime blog for the paper there. Coming up, no more bikinis. The Miss America pageant drops the swimsuit competition. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Miss America organization announced today it plans to drop the swimsuit competition. It's a pageant tradition that was always controversial. Here's the organization's chairwoman, Gretchen Carlson, formerly of Fox News, discussing the change on Good Morning America.
We've heard from a lot of young women who say, we'd love to be a part of your program, but we don't want to be out there in high heels in a swimsuit. So guess what? You don't have to do that anymore. You're welcome. Please come join us.
Well, Gretchen Carlson herself was a former Miss America 1988. Joining us to talk about the end of the swimsuit competition and what it all means is Blaine Roberts, professor of history at Fresno State University and author of the book Pageants, Parlors, and Pretty Women, Race and Beauty in the 20th Century South. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what do you make of this move?
When I read the headline this morning, I have to admit that I was surprised. The Miss America pageant was founded in 1921 as a swimsuit competition. That was its entire reason for existence. And so for the head of the organization, Gretchen Carlson now, to say that essentially the reason that we have been going on now for all of these years, for all of these decades, we're not going to do that anymore, I think is pretty remarkable.
Well, so it was founded as a swimsuit competition in Atlantic City. Basically, why? To attract more people to Atlantic City?
That's right. The tourism boosters in Atlantic City wanted to extend the traditional summer holiday season at the resort past Labor Day. And so they decided that a beauty competition featuring women standing around in swimsuits would do that, that people would stay to watch. But it was controversial from the very beginning, because in 1921, it was not a commonplace occurrence to see women standing around in swimsuits. So there were plenty of critics from the beginning.
And let's just put it into context. In 1921, swimsuits back then didn't look like swimsuits today. They looked like basically dresses.
Well, that's right. Much more of a woman's body would have been covered up. Nevertheless, to fully put it in context, we have to keep in mind that in the decades before 1921, swimsuits were really, really long. They went below your knees. They covered much of your arms. And so in 1921, when these women are out there during the first competition, they were smaller. Not like bikinis today, but they were smaller. And that's why so many people in Atlantic City were taken with this competition.
So it's been controversial since the beginning, and we've been talking about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, which happened 50 years ago today. In the same year, 50 years ago, there was a huge feminist protest against the pageant because of the swimsuit.
Yeah, so what's interesting about that is that by 1968, the pageant was still controversial, but the kind of the reason had changed. Back in 1921, it was controversial because it was just so shocking to see women standing in public in swimsuits. By 1968, the context has changed. And at this point, women are criticizing pageants for holding women to absurd beauty standards. So it's women's liberationists, it's feminists in 1968 who staged this very elaborate protest in Atlantic City, calling out beauty pageants for objectifying women. And in Atlantic City, they actually say that the Miss America pageant treats women like cattle. And this was really the first time that a lot of Americans would have been exposed to the feminist critique of the beauty pageant.
And yet it persisted 50 years.
That's right. So this criticism and this really important moment in the history of feminism in the United States did not kill the pageant. It did become less popular over the course of the 1970s and 80s and 90s, but it persisted. The organizers kept trying to make the pageant more relevant, kind of deflect from feminist criticisms. They started calling the swimsuit competition lifestyle and fitness to try to emphasize the exercise and athleticism. They also added the platform component of the competition in 1989, and that's the component where all participants have to choose a platform, a kind of community issue that they are going to advocate for. So these efforts were ongoing all throughout the 80s and 90s to try to deflect criticism.
But let's face it, it's still a beauty pageant.
Well, that's right. It was impossible to escape that fact. You can call the swimsuit component lifestyle and fitness, and yet the contestants are still coming out in bikinis and high heels.
And still, even now, with the swimsuit competition gone, aren't they still going to be judged fundamentally at the end of the day on what they look like?
It would seem to me that that will remain the case. However, it's possible that the components that go into the final score will change and that the weighting of these different components could, for example, elevate the interview portion of the competition. And that's, of course, where the participants have to answer questions about contemporary events. I personally think that the pageant has really missed the window in which it might reinvent itself to remain relevant to American women. To take this step 50 years after that feminist protest in Atlantic City strikes me as a little late.
Blaine Roberts is a professor of history at Fresno State. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There he is,
yes,
Mr.
Indeed.
Press Play.
In my swimsuit. I asked listeners what they have to say about the Miss America contest. Katie Malia says, turn it into a spelling bee. And Chelsea Pope says, I love movies about pageants, though. Miss Congeniality, Drop Dead Gorgeous, Little Miss Sunshine. When it comes to the swimsuit competition, 31% say it's about time they dropped it. 5% say it's an important part of the pageant. That's a mistake. And 64% said, who cares what the Miss America pageant is doing?
Okay. Well, obviously we do because we did a piece on it.
All
right. Thanks, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Vann. I'll see you tomorrow.